This is the Catholic Movie Guy Podcast.
Hey, hey, hey. You heard the lady. It's that time again, the Catholic Movie Guy Podcast. I'm Steve. I'm the Catholic Movie Guy, the Catholic guy who loves movies. And, you know, we're just a couple episodes in now to this adventure, this grand adventure, which probably has changed many lives by now, I'm assuming. You know, no one's told me directly, and I don't even know if anyone's actually listened yet, but I know that I'm changing lives, and that's very important. I want to give a little bit of background about me, you know, let the listener get to know me a little bit, and why I have a movie podcast. And that's because I love the movies, and I say it like this, I love the movies. I love them. I love going to the movies more than anything. I love going to the theater. I love watching more than one movie in a day. I'm an addict. I love it. I don't even care if it's a good movie. I'll go to the movie theater just to say I did it, just to get that experience of, hey, this is something completely new. Somebody thought enough to put themselves into this film. I'm going to go ahead and give it all I can. So I wanted to let you know the genesis of my love of the movies. Of course, like any good American, I watched way too much TV and movies growing up. But I think if I had to pinpoint a certain time in my life when I realized just how much I love the movies, it would be the summer between high school and college. That's usually a big summer for people. You're wrapping up loose ends. You're spending time with a significant other, maybe, to strengthen that relationship or end it. Maybe you're going to a lot of parties, making sure you get your money's worth out of that period when you're not going to see your friends anymore. But not me. You know, I was never much of a partier, not really what you would call a people person. Instead, what I wanted to do, me and my small group of friends, shout out to Jesse, Minty, and Wody, they'll know who they are, is I wanted to see how many movies I could see before I went off to college. Was this a smart thing to do? Not necessarily. Did it cost a lot of money? Hundreds of dollars. Hundreds. But that summer, I decided I'm gonna see as many movies as I can. Many times we saw more than one in a day, every other day practically. And this is while I'm working, trying to get ready for college, all that stuff. We managed to see during that one summer, and by summer it was really only a couple months because, you know, you got to go off for freshman orientation, all that, early August. We saw I don't know how many they saw. It was always me and then whatever friend I could drag with me. We saw 40 movies that summer, and I managed to save the ticket stub from each and every movie, which my brother Tim will never let me forget and never fails to ridicule me for. It's a little psychopathic, for sure. But the reason that I wanted to do that is because, like I said, there's so much out there, and true, of those 40 movies, were 30 of them, you know, terrible? Probably. Were 5 of them good? Were maybe 2-3 of them incredibly good ones that I would revisit, maybe just one, maybe two. And that's why you do it. You know, you're not looking to make a good return on your investment. What you're looking to do is find that one film, that one piece of art that really says something to you, that becomes meaningful for you, that helps you to relate to others and to the world and to your purpose in life, and that stays with you. And that's what I'm about. You know, I really give my effort to like something that I'm presented with, even if there's not a good chance or even if I'm not interested in it. And if it turns out that it was terrible or whatever, fine, so be it. That's, you know, you write off the cost. But the gains that you make from that 1 out of 40 that stick with you are well worth it. For example, I saw Juana Man that summer, and I enjoyed it. It's terrible. Don't watch it. Please don't. But I'm glad I did it. You know, what the heck? It's good to see something that makes you remember it, even for its horribleness. So without further ado, I'm going to talk about a movie today, again, with the Tim in. The guest list is long, but I've decided to go back to Tim because I think his insight on the movie is great. One of my favorite movies of all time, No Country for Old Men. In fact, this movie is so good that I might say it's my favorite movie of all time. I can't commit to that, but it's definitely top 5. And it makes you think. It's one of those movies out of 40 that you won't forget, whether you like it or not. You definitely won't forget it. The basic plot revolves around, you know, some ill-gotten goods being found by one man and another man being sent to track him down. The character played by Josh Brolin is the good guy who finds the money. He shouldn't take it, but he does. And then he's tracked down by Anton Chigurh, played by Javier Bardem, who is the locus of evil in the movie. and who pursues Josh Brolin. That's the basic plot. In the background is Tommy Lee Jones' character, Sheriff Bell, who's kind of the one who is chasing them both down, but really doesn't want to chase either one of them down, and I think is the most important character and our center in the movie. But, you know, the plot's not really the point of the movie. The questions that it raises are in the plot, but well beyond the plot. And now it's time for a segment that I think will just become an absolute cultural phenomenon. And it's where we call my wife and get her thoughts on the movie. It's called, Did His Wife Like It? Did his wife like it? Hey, honey, it's me.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. You know that movie, No Country for Old Men?
Yeah.
Did you like that?
No!
All right, so we're back on the Catholic Movie Guide podcast, and I'm here with my frenemy, my bro, Dean. Tin Man. And we're going to take a shot at talking about... No Country for Old Men.
It's like deja vu.
Yeah. You know, Tim, how much I love this movie. I've called it many times my favorite movie of all time. I don't know if that's actually true. It's definitely in the top five, for sure. And I got, you know, the whole reason, basically this was the reason I started the podcast, was this movie. Because many Catholics, including ones that I look up to, like Stephen Gradonis at Decent Films, and... even, you know, no disrespect, but lesser bloggers who have reviewed the movie recently, like St. Corbinian's Bear, whose blog I love, but who's not a movie reviewer, basically tagged the film as nihilistic, and that was the impetus to start this podcast, was to defend against that claim. I don't believe the movie's nihilistic. I do believe the movie is harsh. I believe the movie is stark. I believe the movie is ambiguous, but I believe that the movie actually has a very different message. Nevertheless, at worst, I think it leaves it open to us to make sense of it all. So when you first saw the movie, I know you've seen it more than once now, what was your reaction to what the message of the movie was, or the theme of the movie?
I thought the theme of the movie was, what is the response of the good man, yourself as a viewer, Tommy Lee Jones, whatever, in response to implacable evil, maybe even an evil that will triumph temporally or appears undefeatable. Is that a word, undefeatable?
Sure.
And what are you prepared to do about it? I don't, far from being nihilistic, I think it just calls for the response. What are we prepared to do to combat evil that we may or may not be able to defeat?
Right. And the thing that I think of when I think of the movie, which I've mentioned to you before, is this concept of the long defeat, which I guess comes from The Lord of the Rings. I don't know if that was his original thought, but it's a common thought in Catholic traditionalist circles, because we're constantly being defeated in an earthly sense. We know that ultimately there will be a victory.
I don't know how you can say that. I mean, I think the church is running from victory to victory. It's amazing how much it's growing and defeating the secular culture everywhere you look.
Right.
Oh, wait a minute. Not.
Right. Exactly. But we know ultimately there will be a victory, but it might not be, I mean, it'll be somewhat realized on Earth, I get that, but really it's in the next life that our individual victory will come.
And since you turned it theological right away, I mean, I would say yes, and relating it to this movie, Christ is the victor. We participate in his victory. There's no guarantee that we will temporally be victorious. It's not the Tin Man's victory, it's not Steve's victory, it is Christ's victory, and maybe we're just bit players and losers.
Right. And I'm not one of those people who's trying to make every movie into some sort of theological treatise, like the Coens had this in mind, that, you know, we're going to wait for the conversion of Russia and the triumph of Mary's Immaculate Heart or something. All I'm saying is that the movie, I think, is a fairly, certainly it's bleak temporally, but I think it's also a realistic treatment of the problem of evil in the world and the response that is called for from the good man. So I was gonna, you know, talk about the beginning at the beginning, but spoiler alert, let's just go to the end. That dream that Tommy Lee Jones relates at the end is one of my favorite little monologues in movie history. He starts out with he has two dreams. One of them is unimportant, and it's about, you know, I think my dad gave me my money, some money or something. I think I lost it, something like that, which is basically telling us that the entire movie, this whole chase of the money, who's going to get it, how did they get it, who's going to end up with it, all that is unimportant and meaningless. And then he goes to the second dream where he's basically following his father, and his father is keeping the flame alive. He's trying to keep this little bit of light alive in the darkness. And really, on a temporal level, that's all we're called to do, is keep the light lit.
And carry it forward.
And carry it just a little bit forward.
And I love the way they shot the scene, because you're right, the first dream is unimportant, although I think it's actually important. But the fact that it's relatively unimportant to the second dream, and they make him say it anyway, it's just so totally realistic. And how a husband, you know, he's been married to a woman for 40, 50 years, would explain these things to her. But to me, the whole thing about, and I like your take on losing the money, I hadn't even thought of that. But to me, my dad gave me some money and I lost it, is all of this wisdom that we as Catholic fathers and husbands, we want to pass down to our kids, do they hear a tenth of it and maybe they lose it? Maybe everything that we've done is just in vain from a, you know, weight of the scales thing. But in the end, there's that spark, we carry it forward until we can't carry it anymore.
Yeah, and I think the first time I watched the movie, by the way, the first time I watched it, I've never been so captivated by a thriller. Like, I was totally invested, all into it, on the edge of my seat, everything. As far as, like, the first time I watched a movie, it's up there with the most intense experiences I've ever had. But then the Coens subvert all that, and then they end with this explanation of the dream, which I think is the capstone of the movie. But after he explains carrying the light forward, he says, "And then I woke up." And that's the end of the movie. And a lot of people, Stephen Gradonis included, interpret that as the triumph of nihilism. Well, that's all well and good that you had a dream that this was all meaningful, but then you woke up. Obviously, it's saying that it means nothing.
I wonder how he would have reacted to the end of Canticle for Leibowitz.
Well, I haven't asked him. But yeah, I agree. Well, that's a whole different podcast. But yeah, I didn't interpret it that way at all. I mean, the way I interpreted it was, and then you woke up, you're back on Earth, what are you going to do about it?
Right.
I mean, I just don't see it. I mean, every day you wake up and you have to ask yourself, what am I doing? Why am I doing it? And does it mean anything? And you have to answer that.
And he said he woke up after he said the statement that he knew that wherever his dad was, he was there waiting for him.
Right, pointing to an eternal reality.
It's faith. He had faith.
Right. And it might not be the theological virtue of faith, but he had some sort of an inkling of something beyond himself, right. Something immemorial.
Right, so that whole, you have this wonderful tension, you're on the edge of your seat, and then it kind of ends in an anticlimax, seemingly. It's a lot like Metropolitan. It's a lot like Metropolitan.
That's a technical. He's teed up. He is teed up. For new listeners, if there are listeners, anytime Tim references Metropolitan, that's an automatic technical. Two technicals and he's out. Now he's in timeout for a period of 5 seconds. And we're back!
Am I allowed to finish the thought that got me to the timeout?
Don't say Metropolitan.
Okay, but when Tom is trying to find...
No! Don't make me tee you up, seriously. I want to continue talking.
Okay.
Just talk about this movie, if you could, please. All right.
I like to reference great works of art when I'm comparing them to other great works of art.
And we'll just go ahead and assume arguendo that those are both great works of art.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So just talk about No Country for Old Men, if you could.
All right. Well, it's hard to without a frame of reference.
Just talk about the movie.
No, it was terrific. I think Josh Brolin should have won an Academy Award if he didn't. I don't even remember if he won.
He didn't.
One.
He wasn't even nominated. I don't think he was nominated. Well, No. I think he was nominated, but he lost.
Yeah,
Bardem won.
Yeah, I mean, he was great.
Coens won and the movie won.
And don't get me wrong, Javier Bardem is fantastic, and of course he deserved it. But in a way, that is the most obvious of the roles. It's like when they give the Oscar to Marley Matlin because she's deaf and plays a deaf person or something like that. It's tailor-made for an Oscar, whereas Josh Brolin has to tell you so much without ever saying a whole lot. And that opening scene with the, you know, tracking the deer, like you said before, I mean, there's nothing that you don't need to know that comes through in that scene, and he never speaks until he makes that line, you know, Ultimo Hombre, you know, the last man, where is he?
And
maybe the greatest line in the movie when he says, I'm about to do something dumber than hell, but I'm going to do it anyway. I mean, that's just the way he delivers it, and it's so true, and how many, and that's what the good man does. He does it no matter what the consequences are. And I know he put himself in that position, but nevertheless, he makes an act that is good. And that's,
right, and when he says that, I mean, it's his way of saying, I mean, he doesn't, nobody ever explains themselves this much, but you just get the sense he knows this could lead to his death. And that's just the way it is. You just have to do it.
And I also wanted to mention his interactions with his wife, I thought although not maybe not essential to the film, were just so endearing. And she presents such, yeah, and I...
Although he did serve her up in the end there.
No, we'll get back to that. I don't know if I agree with that. But she presents such a wholesomeness, a winsomeness, that I think she is like the truly innocent character in the movie. And although she's not the focus of the movie, at the end, when Shiger confronts her and she refuses to call his coin flip, it's important to note, spoiler alert, that in the book, she calls it explicitly, and then Shiger kills her. In the movie, the Coens don't show that. And I think that by not showing it, they're saying to me that she didn't call it, and she refuses to call it. The only thing we see on screen is her refusing to.
Right.
Because she puts the personal responsibility for an act on
Shiger. Coen don't have no say.
Exactly. It is the complete diametrically opposed worldviews.
Right.
And although she loses, in a sense, because he seemingly kills her, I don't think that matters in our worldview. And I think that she's a hero for refusing to call
it. Right. I think it had an effect on him. And if, yeah. I mean, you can talk about the disequilibrium of him. You know?
I'm going to allow it.
Okay. But to me, you know, he spreads his evil throughout the movie. You know, this whole idea that the movie's nihilistic comes from the fact that he just goes on killing and negating all throughout the movie. But at the end, when she puts the onus on him, you know, the coin don't have any say, it's all you.
Mm-hmm.
Then a little bit of her goodness is now spread to him.
Right.
It's like he's caught the germ of goodness.
He doubts himself.
Right. Not that he's become good, but that it affected him. And
very rarely does somebody become good, but I agree with you. After he walks out of there and he's in the car, he is shaken. I think it's visible on the screen. And I think it's, they tell us that through him getting hit by that car.
He doesn't see it coming.
He doesn't see it coming. Nobody sees that. And afterward, instead of, you know, the kids approach him, and instead of him, you know, trying to leave no witnesses, not only does he, you know, talk with them, but he also gives them money, which he didn't have to do at all.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know exactly what that car crash is trying to tell us, but I think that her goodness, like you said, has had some effect on him. We don't know how it'll all turn out.
And see, I love that car crash scene, because if he had been hit out of the blue by seeming chance
and killed,
it would have vindicated this idea that there's this divine justice and everything works unto good. Which we know it does in the end, but not temporally.
But not temporally, exactly.
We don't have any assurance, like in The Ballad of the White Horse by Chesterton. We have no assurance we're going to win when we're called to do battle against evil.
And that's one of the things that makes me, I mean, I don't want to say angry, but you know me, and you know how passionate I get about art that I like. That's what makes me irritated by these kids. Tim is having a good chuckle over here. Yes, I can go overboard. I'm a nerd. But I do feel passionately about this. That's one of the things that makes me mad. As Catholics, we don't believe in karma. We do not. If he got hit by that car because he's an evil person and died, that's karma. Everything works out. What goes around comes around. All that stuff.
Yet
we just don't believe in.
Another reason why John Lennon and the Beatles are the source of great evil in our world.
Whoa!
They're overrated.
Look, I'm going to call a flagrant, not technical. I'm not going to kick you out. I don't, you know, we're not going to get into the Beatles talk because we know how we feel about that.
All right.
And there's a lot of strong opinions, but it's not directly relevant.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. But there is no instant karma.
Instant karma. It's not good.
Yeah, there's no instant karma in this movie. There's no instant karma in life. Our only resolution comes from beyond. So I like that about the movie, that it didn't give that easy answer.
Yeah, no, it was great. It was just like life.
Exactly.
You make your act of contrition at night, you wake up in the day, you're gonna do everything great, and you end up just being a turd ball all day long,
right.
And you do it all over again.
Some of us more than others.
Right.
Some of us named it Timmy.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, I just enjoyed it. And Tommy Lee Jones, yeah, I cannot let a moment pass without, first of all, giving a shout-out to his face, okay? His face contains multitudes. I mean, the crags and the craters on that man's face. You just look at him, you're like, well, this guy's wise. I mean,
at one point in history, I would like somebody, it could be you or me or somebody better than us, to do a methodological study of the length of his earlobes. As he gets older in the movies, his earlobes, I mean, in Jason Bourne, they're to the floor.
Yeah.
Oh, and they're hairy, yeah. Hairy as heck.
Well, that's almost 10 years after.
Yeah.
But he's got
the Dumbo going.
And then, on top of that, his dialogue and the way he delivers it with a combination of pathos and authority and all, you know, earned wisdom. Age will flatten a man. Put his soul at hazard.
Yeah, all that somebody, stuff. This idea of, you know, to face something you don't know, that puts your soul at hazard. I mean, it's one thing to know the evil that you face, but when you don't know it and you don't know what it's going to lead to, you're putting your soul at hazard.
But also, you know, No Country for Old Men, it's about growing old. And I think when you're young and dumb and you face the evil, or you face it without thought, or maybe in a Brolin-esque way, you're fearless.
You trust in your strength.
Right. But Tommy Lee Jones knows better than that.
And he trusted, that's a great point.
And he does it
trusted
anyway.
In his strength, Brolin, and he got laid out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tommy Lee Jones did not trust in his own strength.
Right.
And yet, he makes the bravest decision of the movie, in a way.
Right. Which leads us to the ultimate scene in this entire movie. Right.
When he goes to Brolin's hotel room after Brolin has already passed.
Kiboshed.
There's a lot of disagreement, if you guys don't know, about what exactly happened in the hotel room. Because Jones approaches the hotel room. It's cordoned off with police tape. And then...
And
no one else
is
there.
Next to it.
In the room next to it. And it shows Chigurh apparently in the room behind the door. And Jones is like, should I? And Jones can see through the empty keyholes, the empty lock slot.
The blown out lock, right, yeah.
That he can see something. So Jones knows that, you know, morally, that Chigurh is in there. Does he enter the room and face his doom or not? And a lot
because
of
he has no assurance of coming
exactly.
out there alive. That's, I mean,
exactly.
he knows
and you can see the fear on his face.
He is putting his soul
at
hazard.
Right. So, eventually, he does go in the room, and then he gives it a quick clear. Apparently, Chigurh's not there when he enters the room, and he sighs a sigh of relief. He retires.
Well, and a lot of interesting things happen in the room, that are interesting plot points. The window in the bathroom is latched. Chigurhing it out the bathroom. You're made to know that he could not have gotten out any other way than through the door if he was in there. And you see the duct where mm-hmm. that's where Chigurh has obviously retrieved the money.
Right.
Because he knew how Brolin had hit it the first time in the first hotel, so the Mexican drug lords didn't get the money because they didn't know. Chigurh got it.
Okay. So Tim and I, there's four popular theories as to what exactly happened. And Tim and I take strong positions on two of the four. I think, if you'll be reasonable with me,
okay,
we'll agree that the two I dismiss here are easily dismissed.
Yes.
And ours are the only possible,
yes,
realistic positions.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to dismiss number four first. Number four is that he's in the other room that's cordoned off. A careful viewing, first of all, it doesn't make any sense, okay? But a careful viewing shows, based on where the door hinges are when they show him behind the door, that he could not be behind the other door.
Okay. The door hinge is the way that you can easily dismiss it. Being in the next room has some antecedent in the film because Brolin took the next room or was trying to take the next room to see if anybody would come back and chase him. So maybe he's doing that. You know, because this is after the scene where... Well, we'll get to that. So, yes,
but,
easily dismissed.
Just visually.
That. Yeah, visually it doesn't work.
There's no cause to believe
right,
that.
Right, so if
and
he's in the other
work,
room...
They made
then
a huge
they,
error. They right. put the door hinges on the
correct.
Wrong side.
If he's really in the other room, then they
Then the
they
Coens
blew
are
it.
Incompetent.
They blew it.
Right, and I don't believe
cinematically.
It. So we're going to throw that one out. Apologies to all you second room theorists. The next one is that they're showing Chigurh there at an earlier point in time, not when Tommy Lee Jones is approaching.
Yes. That's total crap.
It's crap. This movie is hyper-realistic, if anything, which we'll get into in a minute, but they certainly don't use any stylized thing of showing a previous point in time immediately, you know, in between current times. So we're throwing that one out. So now we will go to the two that are possible, realistically.
Okay.
One, Chigurh is behind the door. In the time that they show Chigurh behind the door and Jones entering the room, several seconds elapse. At least,
because he's facing his doom, thinking exactly. It's screwing up the courage, and bam, he's
at least 10 seconds.
Yeah, at least.
So my theory, and I think the one that's probably the most popular, although not necessarily the right one, is that Shagur somehow gets out of the room in that time, or hides enough to get out of the room. My theory is that he moves from behind the door in the time Tommy Lee Jones is waiting to enter, goes to the opposite corner where the drapes are. As Jones enters, the movie makes a point that he does not check behind him to the left, which is a bad police move, but allows him not to see Shagur behind the curtains. Then Tommy Lee Jones goes through the room, and as he's doing that, Shagur slips out. That's theory one.
Yep.
Theory two is that Shagur's pictured because he's a manifestation of Tommy Lee Jones's interior fear, right. Realizing, because he knows inside that Shagur could be in there.
I think that is, to me, the obvious conclusion for a number of reasons.
Obvious. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can shoot him down if you like. Obvious, yes. Here's why.
Obvious.
And
this time... It's one of my favorite things about my brother. When he loves something, when he has a position, he's a lawyer.
Yeah.
Not only does he say, well, I think this is right. He says, this is the obvious conclusion. It's certainly the right answer. So we're going to hear the obvious conclusion of a figment of Tommy Lee Jones' imagination.
It's a type of confirmation bias.
Yeah. So go ahead.
Wow. I apologize for that.
Yeah,
well, here's why I think it's more likely. Here's why I think it's more likely. Okay, we just had that scene of him with the local sheriff who has jurisdiction over the place, and they're exchanging opinions about this guy, and Tommy says, sometimes I think he's a ghost. This was right after the other sheriff said this notion, he goes right back to the scene of the crime. And Tommy Lee Jones knows that. He's been to Josh Brolin's trailer, he's drunk the milk with the sweat on it, you know? So when he's standing at the door and he fancies he sees Shagur behind the door, he knows that it is likely in his mind, or possible at least, that he's there. And if he goes in there, he's not likely to come back out. Is he going to put his soul at hazard? Is he going to say, okay, I'll be a part of this world?
Right, great line.
And it's wonderful. And then it all comes back there. And I believe it's the manifestation of his fear. And how can they show that when he doesn't speak, unless they either do a voice flashback or they show Shagur behind the door. Okay, so when he comes in and he's not there, I don't agree that he doesn't look left per se. He doesn't overtly turn left into the other corner. But you're talking about a guy who goes into the room who is a policeman who has peripheral vision. And he sits down, and Shagur has never, you know, shown a lot of mercy at that point of the movie to anybody that could identify him. And so I think it's likely that he is the manifestation of his fear. And as soon as he overcomes his fear and gets in the room, Shagur vanishes. He's a ghost because Tommy Lee Jones has enough courage to face the situation. Boom!
I'm going to have to... Boom.
Boom!
How about Booyah, maybe?
No, boom.
I would have gone with Booyah.
Hey-o!
Hey-o!
Yes!
Anyway,
it's fantastic.
I'm just going to shoot your theory down. First of all, he does show mercy to certain people.
Shoot. Sorry.
Tim has...
My watch got caught on the microphone cord. Sorry.
My favorite nickname for Tim is the Yeti, because the Yeti smash has its genesis in a camping trip where Tim basically took the tent down and our entire world by his nighttime maneuvers. He's rolling across the thing. He's getting up to go to the bathroom.
I had to tinkle. There were animals.
He's just a complete manimal. His wife calls him Marmaduke for a reason. Anyway.
It's all true.
He shows mercy versus, not killing someone when you don't have to for practical reasons. He does that with the lady at the trailer when he goes to try to find out where Bolin is. He doesn't?
Absolutely true. I don't deny it.
Okay, fine. So I'm just saying, you said never. I said there's one. Two, he kills him in the room. He's creating more of a fuss and muss than he needs. So he doesn't need Bell dead. Bell doesn't know what he looks like. Bell doesn't know where he is. If he gets out of there, it's an unnecessary murder, and Bell didn't do anything to him. Okay? So I'm just putting that to the side. I admit your theory is not only plausible.
We're neglecting one theory also.
He saw him and he walked past.
He saw him, but by his actions, he's indicating to Shagur, I don't see you.
Not only, first of all, I see no evidence in the film for that. Unlike you, I don't see any glance to the side.
But this idea that, let's assume for argument's sake that he notices him, okay? All right. in the scene when he gets hit by the car, all right, and he tells the kids, "You never saw me," and he leaves them alone. That could be a continuation of this policy, that if you indicate that you never saw me, I'll leave you alone. Also, what about that guy in the drug lord's office? And he says, whether he's going to kill him or not, "Are you going to kill me?" He's like, "That depends. Did you see me? Do you see me?" Okay. We don't know how that ends.
Great, but I think that's a point in my theory's favor, because
that he was there, yeah.
Those people clearly saw him.
But is seeing him a Tommy Lee Jones? Will?
If Tommy Lee Jones saw him, why wouldn't he say that to him?
He didn't have to say it.
You don't even believe he saw him. Why are you defending a theory you don't
believe? No, I just think it has more plausibility than I thought at the beginning.
No, it doesn't. So can we please go on?
Okay.
Let's just go to the two that we're trying to keep. Yeah. Yeah, and then there's infinite theories, you know, it doesn't matter. He got out, I think that makes more sense for the simple reason that your theory, despite its merits artistically, has no corollary in this film as far as a sort of hyper a surreal thing. Nowhere else in the film do the Coens use anything like a figment of an imagination being personalized or anything. The whole movie is minimalistic, stark, brutally down to earth and temporal. I don't see it.
I understand what you're saying, and I give it credibility on what you're saying. What you're saying is true. I do think that one of the central, not macro themes, but plot themes of the movie is Tommy Lee Jones a coward or not? He could be a wise person, as I think he is, and he proved to be. Or they were also kind of setting him up as maybe he's just avoiding conflict because he doesn't want it.
Yeah.
And I think that notion he's got to go in that room is so important to that character development that he has to think that Shakur is behind the door, whether it is or not.
Agreed. But that doesn't point in favor of your theory at all.
It points in favor of they might have used a different technique for that scene because it was so important to bring up.
That's post-hoc reasoning. I mean, what's important is that Jones thinks Shakur's in there and that he goes in there and puts his soul at hazard, right?
The problem,
just answer.
Right, but the
problem. So if that's the case, either one of our theories satisfies the theme.
But the problem with your theory, and this is a big thing for me, and I think you know this, there is zero poetry in it.
Poetry to Tim means things happening out of like the normal way they would happen.
Whimsy, beauty, things that are done for a reason that you just have to take. I mean, this is just, okay, guys in room, he hides, he gets out. I mean, big woo. Poetry, my man. Poetry.
Incredulous look.
Wink.
I just, you know, and this is why.
I mean, it's like when it's like when Nick is talking about von Sloniger and he does that composite.
That's it. That's it. It's over. I had much more to say. Much more I wanted to hear said. And yet, through the ramblings of a slightly inebriated...
Metropolitan fan.
And that's the second technical. You're out! It's over. You're out.
All right.
This has been the Catholic Movie Guy Podcast. Thank you for listening. I'm sure we'll be back. Hopefully Tim will be back. He's certainly going to have to be chastised duly for his behavior on this one. You judge. Was Shakur in the room? Was he a unicorn? Was he some sort of a phantom?
He ain't there.
Yeah, I mean, it could be anything according to Tim. What's more poetical than that? We'll talk to you next time. Till then, you know, let's go to the movies.
Keep on traveling.
If you like the music, it's Jazar's Waste Technology, betterwithmusic.com. Check him out. Till next time, I'm the Catholic Movie Guy.